Greetings,
Can you
everybody.
hear me?
Greetings.
Greetings.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Lisa, Michaela, Michael, and Ed. Greetings.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Are you doing?
A whole lot better than I was 13 days ago.
All right. Hi.
You look
Hi.
well.
Oh, good.
Well
Yeah,
enough.
I know. Yeah, it's been a real roller coaster the last couple of weeks.
Yep.
Oh, hello, Jeff.
Hello.
This is somebody new. He found me on academia.edu, and so I invited him here.
Thank you.
Good to have you.
Welcome.
So do we want to wait? Do we want to wait just a couple more minutes? So, Jeff, where are you in the world?
I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. Well, outside of Phoenix, in the East Valley, in Chandler, Arizona, actually.
Okay.
Where are all you guys? Back east?
I'm located in
I'm
Germany.
in California.
Ah.
Yep, California too.
Colorado here.
Great.
And John, who stepped away, is in New York, Manhattan.
I had to
Misha
get
is
my
non-local.
coffee. Hi.
So, how are you? How did you find the reading? This time around.
I liked all
Easy,
the readings.
challenging.
I found them very difficult. I'm very
Already
familiar.
knew it.
Yeah, it was hard, but I enjoy difficult when it's interesting. And I read a couple of his Rosen's books, and I think the essay you chose is great because it sort of summarizes a great deal of research that he's done. So I really particularly enjoyed that one. But I can't read it in large chunks. I have to read it in small chunks because it's just too much to absorb. So I hope that today we can sort all of this out and integrate some of it. Thank you.
Yeah, there was a lot going on in that Rosen article. But it was very
Yeah, that's what
interesting.
I'm hoping we do. So which okay, let me back up. When I was preparing for today and looking back at all of these things in place, how am I going to integrate them? And then I thought, well, that's our work. So it might help to start with questions or I you know last week I just kind of talked through a bunch of stuff, be more dialogical today, and we can work through this Mobile Kleinian dance and figure see where we end up on the other side. So yeah, why don't we start with some questions, if you have any questions.
I'll dive in. In the integral circles, people talk a lot about perspective and multiple perspectives and the aperspectival in Gebser language. And I had been told that I was extremely naive because I said, well, what about perceptions? And they say, well, the perspective absorbs your perception. And I didn't buy that at all. So a question that arises often is, and I'm asking the questions as a group, but I don't expect anyone to answer it, but when you have perspective, where are you perceiving your perspective from? And what I get from this essay, Rosen's essay, is I believe he's wrestling with that. Looking at the Necker cube and the perplexities that the paradoxes that it invites in our perceptual space. And where exactly is that space in which we perceive perspective from, I believe is front and center in most of our attentions. It's very, very important for us and our survival that we can figure this out. And we can't have too many question marks about it. Because then I think it's like that caterpillar. When you ask the caterpillar how she walks with all of those legs, as soon as the question is posed to her, she trips and falls into the ditch. So I'm just opening that up. Thanks.
Since the last time, and one thing I've had difficulty hearing a perspective of, there seems to be, I may be misperceiving, a thing about if you make enough effort, you'll become integral. And I'm really sensitive to that notion of effort because from my training in Zen, you practice an effortless effort. And because effort can actually get in the way of maybe doing the very thing that you're trying to do. So sometimes I struggle with this notion of integral where it just doesn't have enough, to quote Wittencott, unintegration of pausing and letting maybe the integral grow from within without trying to force it to grow, if that makes sense.
So it sounds like you're standing on a kind of Kleinian surface where there's this integration between effort and no effort that is dynamic.
Yes, very dynamic. And that's, I like it, don't get me wrong, but I also know that it's dynamic, that it's like the Buddha said, yeah. The Buddha said in terms of walking his path is not too loose, not too tight. Well, that dance is always happening.
Exactly. Any other questions people want to throw on the table?
Oh, I just had a hard time wrapping my head around the concepts of the Möbius strip and the Klein bottle. I mean, it was very interesting to think about them. And the Möbius strip, you know, I kind of get how it has one side, but it's still a little bit hard for me to accept somehow. And then the Klein bottle is just really hard to wrap my head around. And I guess it helped once I heard people saying that you actually cannot imagine a Klein bottle because it involves the fourth dimension and you don't think in terms of the fourth dimension. So it's actually impossible to imagine it. But I just wondered if you had anything to say that would make it easier to understand the Klein bottle. I mean, for one thing I don't understand is, so if you model it in a three dimensions, it intersects itself, but it's not really supposed to intersect itself. And in four dimensions, it would not do so. And I don't quite understand what's the problem with it intersecting itself exactly, and why would four dimensions allow it to not intersect itself anyway? Thank you.
Those are surfaces. The Möbius strip and the Klein bottle are both surfaces. So keep that in mind. Like, we're not dealing with a wine bottle or a milk bottle. And the notion about it intersecting itself is Möbius strip, and I think on the next workshop we're actually going to make these, and I should have probably borrowed my friend's California, like a kind of a physical model to see the part that goes inside then becomes the outside. And it's this flowingness of a whole surface. So the point about it intersecting itself is that if we could jump out and look at it like the way we look at a Möbius strip, you know, an ant on a Möbius strip, the ant sees it as two sides. But we can look at the whole and see that the whole is unbroken. And similarly, the mathematicians would say, well, in order to see a Klein bottle as unbroken, and continuous, you would need that higher mathematics. Steve Rosen's intuition is that the topological stuff, that's all well and good, but maybe the point is to take that extra dimension, not as an extra spatial dimension, but as, Kate isn't here today, but that would be like the archaic or the archetypal or the psychic dimension that, actually to like get the Klein bottle original realm into that non-spatial realm. And like it meditating on the Klein bottle can enable you to see the fullness, its fullness, its complexity, its dynamicity, its unbrokenness, its maybe that's not quite the right word. It's continuity and its continuity. What Steve is trying to get at by saying the depth dimension, and the depth is the going inside, the going to the we could call it the collective unconscious. We could call it he calls it the priest. I call it the end when you're meditating, and you know, you observe yourself, and then you're like, well, who's the one observing myself? There's an observer of the observer of the, you know, there's always like one more. There's always one more observer, and you can take this ad infinitum. And I just call that the N plus one dimension. And it's going into this, that the Klein bottle can do that, but by meditating on it, you can enter into that paradoxical realm of the merging of let's just say the simultaneous having of boundaries and not having of boundaries. So in the first couple of sessions, we talked a lot about boundaries, you know, both physical and then ego boundaries. And then here, we're getting into this paradoxical world of boundedness and getting in that dynamic opposites. I would say not limited to this, you know, only boundedness and unboundedness. Okay, I feel like I'm just sort of rattling on now. I'm gonna step back and let somebody else come in, and you have a comment.
When you step back, Lisa, how far back do you step? I think this is, I think you're doing a really good job at demonstrating how our language is not adequate to this task. I think we have a tendency to forget, and then we remember And that's because we probably are distracted by a lot of things out there that need, that are calling our attention. The baby is crying, the kettle is boiling, I can hear this, I can hear the alarm out on the street. So I think that, but when we have these special rarefied states in meditation, we can slow down and we can give our attention to multiple senses that have an interplay. And then we go about our business and try to remember as best we can what happens in these very special states. And then we have the dreams that we have every night, which are, anyone who's spent any time exploring their dreams and writing them down will feel the gap that happens, the discontinuity between the language games that we employ with subject, object, verb, and what you remember from a dream that you just had a few minutes ago, which does not fit that particular format at all. But you, if you want to remember something from that experience, you do the best that you can with the language that you're given. So I think that my question, though, it's arising for me. I think what's something that he was talking, Rosen was talking about the Klein bottle and the fourth dimension, but is needed to complete the formation of the Klein bottle, engages the inner dimension of human being. It is not just another area of reflection, one that stretches out before us, rather it is unfolded within us. And he's talking about the pre-reflective depths of our subjectivity. I have lots of questions about the pre-reflective, the reflective, and perhaps the post-reflective. And that personal pronoun I, which seems to be keeping us trapped in an egoic orientation. And I find myself having big questions about that. My experience has taught me that, well, memory, what happens to memory when there is no I, when there's no personal pronoun I? What kind of memory is supposed to be operating so that the inside and the outside, when you go through these boundaries and back across the boundary, what are you taking with you? If you have no personal pronoun I, that can integrate the imaginal with the perceptual, with the so-called real. I'm sorry if I'm starting to ramble a little bit, but I think this is inevitable when we start to embrace these paradoxes. But I think primarily the paradox arises because we're staying stuck in a visual space rather than dealing with the auditory and the kinesthetic and the sense of touch. I think these are the senses that are often neglected in our education, or certainly our Western civilization. And I just want to put that out there also, because when we're in dreams, we all of that can be abandoned, and we can use a repertoire of senses in very different and innovative ways, which we cannot do in this 3D grid.
I'm just curious. It seems like one of the paradoxes or the contention that comes up is how much pressure, or what would be the word,
Michael?
For pressure? Yeah. Am I? Yeah. Is that okay? Continue.
I can hear you.
Okay. How much pressure or I'm trying to find the right word for it, because it seems like when we were in the magical structure of consciousness, words were not as systemized as they are today. And we tend to put a lot of pressure on language in terms of just words, and not the, like Johnny was saying, the multi-sensory perspective that comes into play when we even create words or try to language something from a particular point of view. This is one thing I like about poetry, because it's kind of beautiful in the sense that it can have the precision of science, but the beauty of art, of not letting the precision get in the way of the expression.
I had a question about pre-reflective, pre-linguistic source, like what exactly he means by that. And that, well, actually, when I was reading this article, I was struggling with the, you know, understanding, and then I fell asleep, and I thought that, that something will appear in a dream, and it was a very short dream, and I dreamed of my the village where I grew up in Ukraine, small village, and they were in my dream. There's a puppy that I tried to protect from two geese, and we had geese who were like they would attack to protect their babies. They would like run after you and try to pinch you. And so these two, they were from both like the sides. And I took one goose and put my, like tried to restrain one of them who was more aggressive. And I have no idea why I had this dream. But then I put the goose aside, and it was almost like I almost killed it. And I thought, oh, I shouldn't have restrained it so hard. And I woke up. And then I started thinking, how does this dream relate to that article? I started thinking about, so wholeness, my childhood experiences, my experience growing on a farm, and a big issue for me was the cruelty cruelty or just like the way of life, killing animals. And then like the puppy I protect, puppy, we didn't kill puppies, right? They were our friends. But the geese who had their own world with the little gooselings, they were all doomed to be slaughtered. In the end, like to the next, then we'll get new baby birds. We'll buy them from the incubator. Or sometimes we would have our own like incubator and have them hatched. But it's just like this wholeness. Like I don't know. I cannot even express in words, but this dream gave me like a lot of, like intuitive understanding, even this article, like this pre-linguistic, at my own level of understanding, the article started to make more sense after this dream to me, like through this prism of this little short dream. It's something's beyond language. And then it's, for me, it's also interesting, the text as a Klein bottle, like the for me, it's more like kind of what I would like to explore, the text as a Klein bottle, like whatever we read, the information, what he meant, what how we interpret. So it's like we all have how we don't understand, we couldn't follow, like I couldn't follow his logic, or like I have gaps in my knowledge. But at the same time, this article gave me something that I hadn't had before.
Lisa, are you trying to say something? Because you're a little bit frozen up, and I noticed that your speech was garbled the previous times you've spoken.
This is in a different phase space, I think. So we're going to have to use our intuition.
She's in the fourth dimension.
You had stepped back and maybe too far back.
Lisa, can you hear us? Yeah, okay. Okay. Nod your head. You got us? Okay. Don't you love this technology? It's a miracle, isn't it?
Jeff, I can't hear you, she says.
Were you wanting to add something, Jeff? Or questions you had? I'm just responding to facial gestures, but they may be projected.
Let's work with it. I have a curious question.
Well,
you want to go down?
I can.
Go ahead.
See what thoughts self-assemble. But
why don't you go, Marco? What do you have to say?
I'll go
I'm
back.
I'm feeling
to
lonely what, out here. I do all the talking.
What Lisa, her original proposition, which was in taking language broadband and what that might mean, or how we could construe that. That's a metaphor. We know what broadband means in terms of information throughput. When you have low broadband, kind of like Lisa's internet connection probably right now, we're not getting full spectrum of information that she, you know, is trying to convey to us. We want to receive. We're getting these kind of staggered image, you know, discontinuous flashes and garbled sentences. So I think similarly, the metaphor is I think pointing to different kinds of information, or different, even what we would call information, not being that, different forms of knowing, different ways of perceiving or of experiencing reality. And I think that the distinction between that, John, you raised early or initially in this talk, between perception and perspective is very important. Because I think perception is something that an organism does. It's inherent to an organism's aliveness. It's being, or an organism is, we're all perceiving, we're always in a sensorium, and we're having an experience, a present, real, active, alive, now experience through our perceptions. Perspectives, I think, are abstractions from, maybe from perceptions or preceding perceptions, but they're mental. They're an effect that's created by a play of features. Like, and Gebser is very, very good with this in terms of describing how perspective arises with the mental structure of consciousness. And he tells that wonderful story about the poet. The name is escaping me now, but one of you will remind me. And he climbs up the mountain and suddenly has this aha moment as he's gazing out over the landscape. And Gebser identifies this as kind of the moment perspective is born, because we now, like, as I understand it, and the way I would frame it for this comment, is that we have the kind of technology to create the effect of depth perception. And given like that, we create that effect, we can experience a perspectival world, and we can extend that into all domains, because now we know how it works. But you know, much like say watching a television, if you're at the right distance from the TV, you'll see the image that's being projected onto the screen. If you get too close, you won't see the image. You'll start to see, you know, nowadays with like retina screens, you won't. But 10 years ago, you would see the little pixels, each individual flashing pixel, and there are millions of them. And that is that play of light in those little points, those little dots, is what creates the perspectival image on the screen. I think it's similar with mental perspectivity, is that insofar as we use the kind of technology of creating kind of a grid, a three-dimensional grid of a world that we could then control. We could build roads, we could build space shuttles, we could do incredible, you know, telecommunications technology. So we can do all of that because we know how to create those effects. But what Rosen does in his article, and what I think the figures of like the Klein bottle, the Mobius strip, there are these places in mental land, in like the mental framework, where it's like glitches in the matrix. Like they're kind of like wormholes, like into other dimensionalities, because they're kind of places where the mental like effect like breaks down, and it's an effect actually of looking more deeply, looking deeper into, getting closer, kind of stepping outside of that kind of effect space into the how it works. And I think what it does is it sort of undoes the effect. It sort of abuses us or disillusions us, not in the sense of like the emotional, although that too, but it dissolves the illusion, and then that opens up another horizon. But it's not a horizon, it's not another perspective. And this is where I think maybe I had some questions about the pieces for this week, the emerging paradigm shift and the assumptions it is questioning, Lisa. Because one image that you use is that of what you call diamond consciousness, which I thought was really beautiful and interesting, and it sparked a little drawing, which I'm kind of not that great at these, but I wanted to show sort of just the diamonds and the perspectivity if you start to stack them and assume the different facets and the multi kind of perspectivity. But what I would also point out is that those perspectives are still, I think, mental perspectives, and they're pointing to an embodiment, but they're not actually the embodiment. I think the embodiment is the perception, like the deepened perception that comes from integrating multi-perspectivity into a flow of lived experience. And I think that that flow of lived experience is what we tap into in the fourth dimension, which, as I understand it, is about time. So it's the flow, it's how things move and change. And any perspectival representation is going to be a static like object that allows us to get a fix on things, allows us to, you know, predict cause and effect and do everything that the mind does. But, and it tends to become predominant because it's so powerful. And this is what where we're at now is the, you know, the full, you know, like engorgement of the mental, you know, but it lets out into something else is what I'm trying to say. And I think that that's where we are trying to land. That's what we want to, not trying to, like, that's where we already are, but we get lost in mental land. And what I find is helpful about like Rosen's writings and your writings is that you use the mental to bring us out of the mental. And I think that's the path that we have to take through these texts, because if we approach them from a mental perspectivity, it's not going to work. We're going to run into the paradoxes. We're going to run into them as like concrete walls, to quote like some discussion on the forum. Whereas I think if we are able to be them, like, be the climb bottle, feel what it's like to be a climb bottle, to like have this self-intersecting like flow, then we'll intuit it more so than think it. We'll know it more so than conceive it. So just some thoughts.
Yeah, can you hear me? Let me just pick up on the diamond metaphor real quick. I need to like run and get my diamond. Hang on. Okay. So here we have our standard diamond paperweight, right? synonyms is like me identifying, say, with this little facet here. And so this one, share these edges, we have some common boundaries. It kind of looks like me, it's kind of triangular shaped, and I understand the world through the perspective of, you know, my little facet here. And I assume that all of you are like, you know, all these other little facets here too. Whereas if, okay, so these facets don't exist independent of, you know, the whole chunk of glass here. And if I get consciousness to grok that my perspective exists because basically I am this glass of not seeing myself as the diamond. Okay, and then as the diamond, I can go, oh, hey, cool. I can look at things from this facet, from, you know, this facet up here. I can look at them from down here. I can, you know, look through it. Well, actually, you know, that's assuming, actually, scratch the look through it. That's a whole different thing. But from the perspective of being the diamond, as opposed to just being a facet, I can choose where to put my attention, where to put my perception. And it gives me a lot more choices, a lot more perspectives, you could say, to know that I'm not just this one little facet here, that the facet is a facet by virtue of the fact that there is that actually so what that means, you know, to me personally, then it makes it easier for me to assess it and go, okay, well, what would it be like, you know, approaching if I am, you know, basically wholeness, what if I approach something, you know, from another facet, another way of looking at it. What if I imagine everything around me to be part of my beingness as well? You know, like I no longer look at the blue jay and the tree out there as a blue jay with its own fat perspective. I can shift to being that blue jay and having that perspective. I can shift into and perspective of, you know, the geranium growing out there. Let me show you my other, this isn't, you know, exactly a diamond, but this is a sculpture by a guy named John Kuhn. And it's just, I don't know if you can see it, it's just
tiny, tiny little chunks of glass or crystal all glued together. You know, it kind of, any Star Trek fans, the Borg, big cube. The cool thing about this, and let me see if I can get the, I can't quite get the, so that acts the colors beautifully. But this thing, if some can do it with my phone, it just, it bursts you. Zoom's not quite doing it. But basically the light refracts through this, you know, and each little piece refracts the light in its own way, and it just, it's actually very stunning. I also use this as a metaphor for, you know, wholeness, that the light, source, being, whatever word, you know, flows through us, and we refract according, you know, to our own, you know, like makeup, our own constitution. Some of us are musicians, some of us are dancers, some of us are writers, some of us are thinkers, and so forth. But if any one of these little pieces were missing, you know, the integrity of the whole would be gone. And but I kind of see what's happening with biodiversity and our loss of biodiversity these days as being like pieces of the whole are starting to fall out. That's not really where I wanted to take this, except to say that we can come from various perspectives to ask the question, what is this? Come from the whole diamond. And there's great paradox, I think, at the heart of it, that understanding the both and-ness, and this is why the you know, the Klein bottle and the Möbius strip. Oh, because here it's Cooper, it's Harley. Say hi to Harley and John. Oh, hi, Harley. That's John. Strip in the Klein box as models, just to bring the parallel, the facet and the diamond. Ed? Hi, Kate. Ed, do you want to say something? Unmute.
No, I was just waving to Kate. She showed up.
I'd like to say something if I can.
Okay.
You're muted, Kate. You're muted.
Kate, you're muted too.
I thought it started at 11. I'm completely terminally confused.
Can I say
welcome. It's being recorded. You can catch up. Michael, had your hand up earlier, but
I haven't
done that long.
So this is a experiential report of what's been going on in this cafe with, like Marco was pointing out, of your internet connection and doing my best to grok what you're saying and stuff. And this is where my attention is with the edge of perception and perspective and the paradoxical nature that can come online, you know, when you're faced with a perception and, like with you, trying to get to your perspective or have some sense of your perspective in a kind of fragmented way. And so to go back to my earlier, this is why I think there's not enough talk about experiential, the tension, the effort that we have to make these shifts. And from my perspective, one of the reasons it's so difficult to make the shifts because of the way we've been socializing that is to open up to anything new is fucking scary. I remember my firstborn child, I was living in anxiety for a whole year of how to treat this young life. And I got my sea legs, but some of this stuff, when I'm listening to it, I actually resonate with it, but I'm resonated with it in the sense that the energy that goes into bringing this forward has an edge that is scary, anxious producing. And Marco was referring to affects, and I like the way he broke it out, because it's not just emotional affects, but the emotional affect seems to be kind of a, from my meditation and my interacting on this site, seems to be a component that, for me, I can't speak to anybody else, is where I get, if I acknowledge that, that's where I get the best growth from the conversations. There you go.
Okay, it's scary. And there's an affective element that is very uncomfortable. It's kind of like cognitive dissonance. We don't like to be in cognitive dissonance. We like to and not stay in that tension of both at the same time. Basically what I'm trying to do is make that kind of cognitive dissonance a little more mainstream, so that we don't keep jumping from one pole to the other pole, from staying stuck in one perspective and not moving out into other perspectives. It's hard, I won't deny that.
Can I jump in there? Unless Kate? I'm sorry, Kate, were you gonna speak?
After you.
Oh, okay. Lots is going on here, and it's very confusing. And perspective has been, is mental. Some of us would agree with that. Um, But I would say that it's also mostly visual. And there's much more going on in our sensorium than the visual system. But it is extremely important. And I do believe many researchers, I think Rosen would agree, that the whole subject-object issue arises in the visual system primarily. And I think it's that what they talk about object constancy and how is that achieved in the infant is very important. How mama comes in, you know, rocks the baby, nurses, puts the baby back into the crib. An hour later, she comes back with her hairdo and her makeup on and smelling with perfume. And so those are totally different kinds of senses that are being conveyed through the child. But how does that child make sense of these two very different contrasts? And that object constancy is extremely important for the infant to flourish and function later as an adult. I think that same issue happens all the time. And especially when we were talking about, as I think Marco was previously about perception and perspective, and how the perspective, what is the relationship between perspective, which is more abstract and perhaps abstracted from the perceptual. But of course, Marco wasn't really clarifying how that happens. And what happens when we start to abstract upon our abstractions and abstract upon our abstractions upon our abstractions. And many of us are calling that going meta. And going meta, of course, is extremely powerful. But I think it's when we're using the mental framework and primarily visual, where the subject and object are very different, have very different arrangements than when we're talking about rocking a baby to sleep or holding the hand of a loved one when they're ill.
You froze, John.
Miriam rearranges itself in radically different ways. And how do we put all any of this into words that would make sense to another person? This isn't arbitrary. I don't think our language is something private that we just make up. Actually, I think it's just the opposite of that. I think our language is extremely public and is shifting constantly, changing constantly. So I think that's, well, what are we basing our perspectives from if we're abstracting them from a sensorium which is in constant state of flux? And this, I'm trying to make a connection between this conversation we're having now and focusing on Rosen and the other reading, which was on biology and biological process. I just wanted to I'm just quoting from that author. In that biology text, when can we think, he's talking about hierarchy, molecules, cells, organs, organisms, populations, and so on. These are hierarchies. Although the members of this hierarchy are usually thought of as things, we contend that they are more appropriately understood as process. This sounds like that old conflict between nouns versus verbs. And I think you've touched on this quite a bit too, Lisa, in your paper. And things should be seen as abstractions from a more stable process. But that more stable process is not that stable, we're finding out. So, and he's talking in that paper about substance, that which stands under something else, which makes that which is above it stable. And that tension between that way of thinking is, in the biological sciences is becoming, really front and center in a lot of biologists' attention. So I'm just bringing that all forward, and hopefully we can, there may be a tension between the Rosen text and this other text, the biological text, which is advocating a process-oriented biology. And, the ordinary everyday experiences that we're all having as we move from the internet to TV to an article that we read to a walk down the street with masked faces all around us. and trying to make sense of a world which is in so much flux right now, and where we're bombarded by external images, which are produced by sometimes algorithms, and how do we integrate all of this information? And I would make the case that we need to focus our attention on the endogenous imagery, such as we have in reverie or trance states or in sleep, and being able to, rather than divide the world up into another binary where we have exogenous images and endogenous images, I would like hopefully a maturity where we can do both and much more effectively than we're doing now. Because we're in this paradox of having to change the world, which is changing much faster than we, any of us have bargained for. And we're having to interpret and reinterpret and reperceive after we have all of these different kinds of adventures. So I don't think our perceptual system is sitting still, providing a platform for the meta. I think it's all in incredible chaos right now, or at least that's how I'm experiencing it here in Manhattan. Thank you. I hope that made sense to somebody.
I just wanted to say that the Klein bottle.
Okay, Kate, and then.
I was just going to say that I love the metaphor that he used in the Klein bottle to postmodern theory, because every time you deconstruct something completely, you know, the postmodernists say no narrative is true except their own. And then they bring themselves into the paradox described in the paper. You know, where is ultimately the final attractor behind which we can base any statement we make? And postmodernism kind of demonstrates the complexity of the paradoxes that we're in. And I just wanted to say that I actually don't get to this realization intellectually. I'm more of an intuitive intelligence, but I wake up every morning in complete paradox. Time is a paradox. Everything that I experience in the inside and outside simultaneously is a paradox. And I think that's what John was addressing when he said we're trying to integrate many different dimensions at once. And ultimately the question underlying all of this is, what is the ground of it? What's the attractor? What final resting place are we using as a base point? Once you deconstruct everything, well, where are you? You know, you keep going into a self-referential circle endlessly in a meaningless kind of loop. So to me, it's a metaphysical question that we are coming up against, because that's what the culture is coming up against. So thought is the medium that moves between the external and internal worlds. And so that is the structure of the Klein bottle as he's describing it. As far as I can tell, I don't know what everybody else's hit is on it. Yeah.
Jeff, thanks. Unmute yourself, Jeff.
I wanted to bring, I was interested in the pre-linguistic I've done work for a number of years. Well, it's also addressed by Erin Manning in her book Relationscapes, and also in the minor gesture that we read together. It's this idea of a pre-movement anticipation. So before one moves, does anything in movement-wise, there's a kind of, it's not understood as a representation, it's not understood as a plan, although the biologists do talk about planning, but we're not really talking about that. We're talking about a kind of latent anticipation of movement before it happens. And dancers use it. I work with a dancer and we've been working on the concept. So it's interesting because linguistics or language use is also movement. I mean, to speak or to write is a movement action. You move your mouth, you move you write, you have to move your fingers or whatever it is that you're using as a means to write. So there's a relationship to some extent between this idea of a pre-movement anticipation and a pre-linguistic effect. And it has to do with what Johnny's talking about as well, because it's another one of those areas that have to do with pre-verbal, non-verbal even elements of what's going on. And I think movement is, again, I still think everything I've done for the last 20 years suggests to me that we still put movement into the periphery and we put thought into the front. But thought is a kind of movement. It's a continuum with movement. And so the sort of artificial separation that between things that are movement body-based and things that are thought mental-based is false. And if we resituate movement in the front, I think we'll come to a clearer idea of what's actually going on. Anyway, my two cents.
Thank you, Jeffrey. That's putting what I was trying to put in words better. Thank you.
So let me just add one more thing about Möbius strips and Klein bottles. They're called non-orientable surfaces, which means there's no top, there's no bottom, there's no left, there's no right, they're just non-orientable. And I think that non-orientableness is part of the cognitive dissonance. We like to orient, you know, we have front and back and top and on the side. We love things orientable. And when we get these, we're into paradoxes, a lot of times we can easy orientation. Culturally, that's kind of, where we're getting to. This is a bit of a tangent, but maybe it'll be, okay, let's try this.
Is Lisa cutting out for everybody else? Because she's cutting out for me.
Yeah, that's been an ongoing problem, Kate.
Okay.
But we're dealing with it.
It's hard to understand you, Lisa, because you're cutting out.
I'm sorry about that. I think it must be either my microphone or my internet connection.
You could call your internet provider. I was having this problem a lot. I'm making a suggestion that you call your internet provider and ask them to refresh, because I was having this problem a lot last week. And every time I call them and say refresh my system, within a minute, it's working fine. So that may be of help to you, Lisa.
Also, what could help is if you turn your video off, your audio might come through clearer, and we wouldn't get to see you, but we'd hear what you have to say.
So, Lisa, is the non-dimensionality like the like thought doesn't have a dimension? But it's real.
How are you doing now? Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
hold it, non-dimensionality, non-orient.
Well, there she goes.
I think this is very interesting because
can you hear me?
No.
Yeah.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, and now.
Yeah. That's the only thing we heard.
This reminds me of those experiments that Stephen LaBerge and others did, trying to communicate with lucid dreamers and getting them to like move their eyes in certain patterns in order to establish lines of, you know, across the threshold. It's something like that, it seems.
Yeah, it's also a very similar communicating to a child that's learning language, trying to feel into what they're trying to communicate. From my experience, I love that stage with my two children of, okay, how can I?
Yeah.
How can you put a higher dimensional truth into lower dimensional terms?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's a perfect challenge for me because it entails a certain patience for the one that's at a different place than you.
Yeah. I'm going to just jump in with something. I hope this ties some of this together because I know we're all sort of going all over the place, but we're also, I'm drawing upon Jeffrey, the work that we did. You quoted her, or Erin Manning's work, the dance. She's a philosopher of dance in many ways, but I think there's something about speech. We call it language, but there's speech, the spoken, and then there's the written. And they're very, very different dynamics. And speech is breath that has a structure to it. Now, I can think a lot of thoughts in my head, but if I want to communicate those thoughts to another person, I need my breath. And I need my lips, my tongue, and my teeth. And I'm anticipating a great deal of what that other person might be interested in and what they're not interested in. And I'm drawing upon our recently shared past. So I'm moving forward and I'm also referring to a past. And so the anticipation has a lot to do with what happens. But I think in writing, it's a very different arrangement. We have but we're still working with our hands. We're typing or we're using pen and paper. And that's very gestural. And that's why I plead with people, don't give up your handwriting. Because A, B, C, D, E, F, G, when you learned how to do writing, lots of stuff got installed at a very deep level that's going to be lost very quickly if you stop doing that and go to typing. I think this is very important also for writers to keep that handwriting going because there's lots of different ways of accessing memory that typing just actually inhibits or dampens. So I'm just bringing that forward because we talk about language sometimes very loosely, what we're meaning by language. So I'll just press the pause button having said all that and maybe hopefully that makes sense to somebody. Oh, syntax. There's also dancers. Dancers go meta all the time. We talk about mathematicians and writers, but dancers they take movement and they go meta to that movement. I can do this. I can do this. And then I have to sort of do something that's both of them. So I'm just giving you how our kinesthetic proprioceptive system is much smarter than this yakety yak, don't talk back, verbal shit we do. And this is where we're integrating. I think our bodies know how to integrate a great deal of information. This is that mysterious analogical messy stuff. than our, you know, verbal parsing, separating, dividing, categorizing, going meta, abstract upon abstract upon abstract. But I am also saying there's a relationship between the abstract and the perceptual that's ongoing, and different art forms explore this relationship in very different ways. So I think artists and dancers and musicians work with abstraction at a very high level, but this isn't given a whole lot of attention in the curriculums that, you know, were used to educate me in my factory model education, which is very much all about math and science. Anyway, just sharing that with you guys. Hope that's of interest, and thank you very much for your attention.
Go ahead, Kate.
Aren't we talking just about consciousness and the different intelligences we bring into it? I mean, there's kinetic intelligence, there's intellectual intelligence, there's intuitive intelligence. We've all got our pet intelligences for sure. It's supposed to be a synthesis of all of them. And with this synthesis or integration of all these intelligences, it embellishes and expands our consciousness. I mean, I think that the vessel, bottle, is essentially a model of consciousness, self-reflecting and renewing itself without changing and yet changing. I mean, the paradox of consciousness is what we're talking about. And John, you're right in the fact that certainly dance as an intelligence, kinetic intelligence, is marginalized. My daughter's a dancer. I think the visual arts are very misunderstood. I'm an art teacher. But the point is that all of these intelligences are valuable, and that what we're talking about isn't one kind of intelligence being better than another. We're talking about a synthesis of all of them. So it's not your body or it's mind in the most expanded definition of mind. Whatever the attractor is behind all of it, that's what we're really questioning. What contains it?
Well, everything that you said, Kate, involves a certain skill set of how to bring all those factors together. That's a skill set.
Evolution.
And in terms of the tractor and what's the ground, I'm probably too influenced by Zen. I think we make too much of needing a certain solidity, you know, solidness to move around. And I think, you know, we supposedly came out of the ocean, where our ground was the ocean, our environment was the ocean and moving in water and not just on earth. But I think we, just like eyesight or vision has been kind of dominant in terms when we took the perspective, learned about perspective, and that went beyond hearing. Our main sense before then was hearing, according to Gebser. And, you know, when we walk on land and we get used to it and we don't spend time in another environment that's fluid, I think we get freaked out if our intellectual beliefs and common sense are just collapsed and gone somewhere. And what I like about Zen meditation is it says kind of like be with the ambivalence and the non-orientation, because whatever is attracting us is beyond whatever we can think of or even feel, from what I have experienced.
I only mentioned the attractor because I think it's whatever form you give that archetype of the self, it kind of defines your cultural background. Everybody has a preference for their own, and I don't have any problems with them. But I think that we talk around it and keep looking for a source of this, what compels us, that which compels us, we keep questioning what that is. And so people come up with models for it. You know, it's Enki sitting on his mountain, or it's Christ on the cross, or it's, we come up with images for it. They're archetypes. There are images for an archetype that we cannot express, because you're right, we can't know it. But it doesn't matter if we can't know it, if we can come up with with mythological images that center us. That's what culture does.
Fair enough, but I think sometimes, again, sometimes we get so attached to having a model and creating a model, we don't learn how to be without a model and be okay with that, and then maybe organically create our own. I have a certain trouble with archetypes as much as I can appreciate. They tend to be used in absolute senses that I don't agree with. They have relevance, but when people start using them as a main grasping for reality, I think that's when you enter into a stage where you're grasping at after reality only from your own self-referential need for it.
I think archetypes, images for archetypes, are unavoidable. I think that we all navigate with them, whether we call them that or not. And you're right. You're right. You can be too invested in thinking that that's a reality.
I understand
the problem. Like our fixation about God being an old man sitting on a...
Exactly.
To me, that doesn't get in my way because I know that's not what it is. I love the images. And I understand what it's supposed to signify. So if you're looking at the something as signifying something beyond, is it perfectly okay to have Enki sitting on his mountain? You know, if you love the mythological significance of time meeting eternity with the cross, you understand the significance. And you don't have to think that it's that person hanging on a cross. You understand the mystery it represents. So it's just the degree of sophistication you can bring into your understanding of archetypes, but they help you navigate. We navigate through pattern. We navigate through understanding the story. And the story is animated with these archetypal images that are not concretely what they say they are. They just point a direction. If you can look at mythology that way, it's useful.
I understand everything you said. I just see a danger if we're not willing, to look at how we're grasping and we're holding on to those things in such a way that we're not really open to something that's larger to any image or model or pattern that we have.
And I think there's a danger in ignoring them because they are...
I'm not trying to say to ignore them. I just, like a skill set, like learning how to use a sword, you better know when to use it and not to use it. When to divide it, when to stick somebody, when to defend yourself. Because part of the problem for my, and I'm being very, very intense about this, part of the problem, we keep arguing over each other's images of God or whatever, and that causes violence. That's the danger I'm pointing to.
Yeah, I acknowledge that danger.
I'm interested in the attractor, Kate. You mentioned several times the attractor. And I'm wondering, is there one attractor, two attractor? How many attractors could be operating in an individual sensorium in a culture which is as complex as ours? And that's why I think the very, very old, the archaic, is a great interest to us. And we know about it because we have artifacts and we have art and we have evidence that's physical about how their psyches must have functioned in order to come up with those artifacts and to have used those artifacts. Same thing with architecture. But I'm just wondering about what's the future. And I think that's where I believe that archetypes, as valuable as they are not going to give us the answers to the future because we don't have. And also, that's why I think models and meta models are extremely important. And what's useful in one area, we may have to drop that in order to explore another area. I have dreams frequently that I can use Jungian archetypes to fit them into, but I don't have to. There's many different ways of working with them. And I think that the whole idea of using chaos theory and attractors and basins and all that those metaphors are extremely powerful and compelling, especially as we live in this highly evolving technological culture, which is making us change our behaviors in order to communicate with one another, especially now in this epidemic, we have to use these flat screens, perhaps in ways that we've never been so dependent upon them before as we are now. So I think these are big question marks for me. And I continue to model and to meta-model and to model other people's models, even as I recognize that there's a lot going on in between those modeling projects that are never going to be captured by anyone's model. But we do the best that we can and we muddle on through, you know.
Well, I understand Michael's concern. I understand Michael's concern about archetypes because I think we're now in a war with archetypes. We haven't, you know, in Jungian psychology, if you don't develop your understanding of the archetypes, they become demonic, which is the version that Michael was talking about. Archetypes are things you cannot know. You can't know them because they exist beyond, I mean, they are behind the mystery. But you follow them to understand them better because in understanding them, you harmonize their energies. When you don't investigate them or understand them, you suppress them and you come up with these false realities like we live in. They become demonic, which is what we're seeing out there. It's those forces that are blowing aren't individual voices. Those are archetypes. On the right and the left, that is what happens to archetypes when you don't evolve with some understanding of them, because they are us.
But can you use certain archetypes and reject other archetypes? Do you have some sense of agency over which archetypes are going to be most active in your life? Or are you just acting on
them? You make them much smaller than they are. I don't know the archetypes. I only know the mythological images that emerge in culture that represent some kind of metaphor to them. I'm navigating by the mythology that forms the ethical systems that I've grown up in. The historical models of reality I've grown up in are the force, and they're created by archetypal forces. But I don't know the archetypes. I can only help evolve my understanding of them. Archetypes aren't something we created.
Well, then where do they come from?
That's the attractor. Behind everything is this structure that's hardwired into our hard drives where we respond to border experiences a certain way. We all hate, love, and die in somewhat the same kinds of border experiences. And we use archetypal imagery to try to put meaning on it or to try to have an understanding of it. But it's never perfect. We don't see God in the face, whatever that is. We don't see ultimate reality in the face. We only see the artifacts created out of these attractors working through our imagination, build culture. We build cultures from these forces. And if our culture becomes outworn and we are not really understanding the power of these things correctly, they become demonic. And that is where we are, in this sort of deluge mythology, you know, with no ark. And the forces of the archetypes are now in a very negative form, screaming through different people. We need to have a deeper understanding of them. The forces that are behind are becoming.
So, can you hear me yet?
I can.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. We're coming up to time, and I'd just like to say that the patterns I'm putting forward in terms of, you know, Mobile and Kleinian paradox, things that embody paradox, might help us through, you know, our being stuck with various forms of concretization They might give us a metaphor, a way. I don't want to say archetype, but maybe I will. For new modes of being that are come from ways that allow for more flux and movement, more dance, if you will. I'm a dancer myself. And continue plus and this mobile or Kleinian thing. In the next workshop, we'll actually like look. We'll get physical. We'll make them. I'll bring John's Klein bottle and we'll go into the body experience of dynamic balancing. You know that these forms embody a kind of how can we bring that kind of understanding? Here's the question going back to taking language broadband. How can we bring that into language? The dynamicity, there is this paradoxical, if we look deeper, if we look through the depth dimension, you know, we'll find it all over the place. One other thing I wanted to run by you is the workshop. I'll put it in chat.
Well, we're just about, you know, out of time. I think even though the continuity and the flow of the conversation was pretty interrupted just by the technical issues, which hopefully, you know, you could look into, call your ISP, your internet service provider. It could just be a simple thing like resetting your router that might clear it up. But I think please definitely do that because I want to hear what you have to say. And I think you could probably help us tie together these disparate threads. One of the things you put into the chat, Lisa, which I'll repeat for the benefit of people that didn't look at the chat or are watching the recording, is that you asked Michael and Kate whether their perspectives could be seen with respect to archetypes, their perspectives could be seen on a Mobius strip. How does one turn into the other and that turn into the first? I thought that was really interesting. And I feel that. I feel that they're both on the same continuum, but from different sides or angles or vantage points. So I appreciate that. I think one thing that we could bring into this, and just to drop this, is that, you know, when does language become code? Because code has to be precise. Code has to give instructions. Code can't be ambiguous. And a lot of, I think, what we've done in the mental rational world is turned language into code and conflated them so that, you know, we tend to see the world and see things in those binary terms. And almost all systems are predicated upon that kind of construction. But then we go meta-systemic and we see that that's what we've been doing. we can, in a way, return to a more holistic kind of language where there's a place for code, there's a place for top-down linear directionality, but there's also more of, I think, an integration with the breath-based mode of communication and being, where code is not just kind of out doing things divorced from our organic embodiment, but it's serving our organic embodiment. It's making our lives better. And so that's just something that was sparked for me by these last few comments as more a direction we might explore. And I certainly will explore. Let's maybe just to open it for any closing words from anyone here. I'd love to hear from those we haven't heard from yet. And then we'll transition. I know we have another call in 2 weeks and then the workshop, I believe, right? Because we're doing the workshop after every other session.
I think Lisa wanted to change that. I think wanted to make a workshop. She said the workshop and the class in 1 week is too much for her. She mentioned that last time.
Oh, so like...
we're going to have to reschedule, yeah.
Okay.
So we'll have one event a week rather than try to do a workshop with a class discussion back to back.
Okay, I like that. That sounds good to me. Why don't we work that out?
Yeah.
We'll make that an announcement to the group on the forum. So anyway, that's it for me. I really appreciate this. I love spending time with this material and with all of you. So thanks and see you again soon.
Thank you, Marco. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
See you next time.
Keep that rhythm going, okay? Stay safe and stay strong, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kate. Thank you.
Take care.
See you next time. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
So, Marco, can I ask you one quick question? I know you got to go, right? You got to go? Okay. You're muted. You're muted. Can't hear you.
I don't have to go at this precise minute. Is your question, though, related to our conversation or is it totally off topic?
To what you just displayed. To what you just displayed about code and language. And I want to know if based on what you described, is some of our concern is how code is coming back to turn the organism into a mechanical thing, overriding and not appreciating. I'm not dismissing code. I'm just saying the way it seems sometimes to come at us.
Yes.
Okay.
The word that I was looking for, Vincent Horn of Buddhist Geeks, who I think you probably know.
Yeah.
And he uses it with respect to Dharma, but here I would call it decoupling. He uses the word decoupling.
Okay.
When code or systems become decoupled from their human sources, like we created these systems to serve us because we were able to predict events and plan for them. So
go to the moon, fly to the moon.
And anything. I mean, almost anything that we could do, and we use symbolic communication systems, language, in order to do that. So we use language as a technology to communicate our understanding of the patterns of reality so that we could anticipate them and work with them and
build
things out of them, right? But then that function of language where we can codify things and use that codified understanding to pragmatically like make our way in the world becomes decoupled from our human context and human scale. That's, I think, where the problem is, because then the code it decouples and it keeps on growing. It keeps on gaining power. and then comes back and it starts to act upon us in ways that are no longer integrated with their, you know, the original purpose of even creating machines in the first place. Like, we created machines to serve human needs. Now humans are serving the machine's own self-perpetuating kind of process.
Exactly. And this just reminds me, wasn't McLuhan trying to warn us of that? Marshall McLuhan?
You know, I've only read a little bit of McLuhan. Okay. So I can't comment like in any scholarly
way. No, that's fine. I know Jeremy has a really good take on McLuhan and how that worked.
I'll definitely get there because I got the essential McLuhan. I think I listened just more recently. There was a Weird Studies podcast. Revisiting McLuhan and JF and.
But I like how you as far as making us aware of what this coding, how it is, my language has gotten away from us in a sense. It's gotten away from the human organism. Not that it's only bad in the sense that of how you pointed out to the effect it's having. Now it's coming back controlling
us. Well, I mean, the connection there's a connection with what Kate was talking about, which is the archetypes. In a way, you can look at archetypes as a kind of deep code.
There's scripts
for how to respond, you know, to life conditions, right? And then we have the code for the martyr, the tyrant, the father, the hero. Mm-hmm. You know, and then those scripts play, you know, get played out through different characters and given local particularities. So, you know, a tyrant in the 20th century or 21st century looks different than a tyrant in the first or second century BC, but we can see the same pattern in play. And that's why I think in one sense, to what John was saying earlier, like the future, in a way that if we understand deep code, then we can see what the future holds because we can see that something is going to play itself out. Now, we can go along with that or not. If we don't want to go along with it, then the future is open. If we fall prey to the code that's going to run over our own more conscious intentions, then history will repeat itself, right? And just within a kind of new face and new guys and different technologies and different culture, but it's the same deep code. So I think that part of what, you know, what you're pointing to with the Zen is sit in like emptiness, see through the code, like see the, or to what Kate was saying, the attractor, the origin, the see source, and then you're not, then you have the spaciousness to work with rather than be subject to the script or the archetype or the code.
That one of the things I like about in terms of this, like you're pointing to, of emptiness or impermanence or, you know, another word is the interdependence is associated with emptiness and impermanence from some of my readings of the Zen teachers I listen to. And is it the Heart Sutra, form and emptiness, how they...
Form is emptiness and emptiness is form. That is the Mobius strip right there.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I wasn't trying to, I just got intense because it's like the other side. I was saying there's another side to this that I wanted to bring forth with, because I won't dismiss what she's saying, but I just sometimes think that perspective is vulnerable to getting locked in more so than if you, because from the formlessness, the way the Heart Sutra goes, you're still going to include form. It's just you do it with more spaciousness. You know, it's breaking the either or in a way. It's breaking through. Is the way I experience it.
Yeah, I resonate with that as well.
Okay.
I liked hearing the dynamic between you, actually. Yeah, itself was interesting.
I know. I watched your face. You smile when that dynamic gets like this.
When we have a surface. A surface is a gradient, right? There's different. You need an intensity to have a surface, to have the difference between the surface and what's not the surface.
So, like water has tension, has a surface tension. Water.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's what I was, I think, appreciating is that having those tensions in play is what gives shape to the dialogue. Yeah. It's what, if everybody agreed, then there'd be nothing to talk about. So I appreciate the dynamic. And I think that's different too, because it's not about one or the other side being right.
It's about
how they dance, how they move.
Yeah. And that goes back to me. I'm just going to loop it back. And this feeling that, I was feeling the tension, the effort. Do I jump in? Do I not? You know, before I did, that's feeling my intensity with awareness to guide my action, not just because I have a past history of not being able to do that. You know, just let the intensity run my mouth and run my behavior. Well, that doesn't work.
True. It's good to be able to hold intensity.
Yeah.
That allows other intensities to sort of arise. Yeah. I mean, this is the problem with Trump, is you only get Trump. Why does he have to come into my brain right now? But
because he's an archetype.
But I mean, I was thinking about that debate that occurred last week and the dynamic of the communication between them and like the total breakdown in flow between intensities. It's just one intensity trying to dominate another.
Exactly.
So that's what makes it so unsatisfying to watch and so just destructive to to discourse, to culture, to society, to civilization, is that you have these like rogue intensities, which, you know, can have a role to play. Like what he's doing that purposefully, you know, in consciously or unconsciously, to be disruptive, like to break things, to break the system, because that's how he has power. But we have to, I think, imagine how we can work with those kinds of intensities, because there's a lot of intensity that he's representing.
Oh, yeah, true. I need to be aware of how his intensity is affecting me, how it lands on me, and what I do with it next.
I think he's a great teacher. I think he's the greatest teacher that, you know, a lot of people are going to find in this lifetime. But and not in a positive way, just, you know, like study Trump, see what makes him tick and what makes him work. Because if you can learn to do that without all the bullshit and nonsense and, you know, vile, gross, disgusting, criminal aspects of it, then you're going to be really powerful. You're going to be able to do things that.
Yeah. You're going to own your own power and not let him jack your power from you, because whether for good or evil, because as far as I'm concerned, the Trump supporters are getting jacked by him too. They're just getting jacked in a different way, because he represents that, and this is where Kate's right, he is representing an archetype. Jeff Salzman really lays it on the line. He's a warrior, you know, he has a warrior type archetype that is savage, not the refined archetype that's come through the centuries.
He's amoral. Archetypes are amoral. So you can't apply moral categories in dealing with it. And that's not to say to become immoral.
Mm-mm.
That's very different. But it's to, I think it has to, it changes, like, I think, the mindset. And this is all unfolding. So we're all learning this in real time. But where I think we can also draw on what, if we have historical knowledge and we have memory, then we can draw on what we've learned from past encounters with this archetype.
Exactly. And I want to say, in terms of this, the way I hold this moment in time is I inform myself of the global, what's happening, you know, but limitedly, because I don't like it, because it jacks my nervous system. So I'm very, it's like a diet. I don't feed it too much, just enough, you know. And but when I'm in the street and interacting with people, the proportion on the ground, there's more people being kind to each other and just trying to do the best. Even if they're Trump supporters, they're just trying, they're just as much shaken up, and but they're still trying to be kind and not add to the crisis. So I try to proportion of feeling into that. What the medium does is deproportionalize it and focus it in such a way that you don't, and the only way you can do that is yourself. Walk around, you know.
Yeah, no, don't spend too much time in the circus, you know, like,
yeah,
that's
exactly
what this is. Like, that's the Colosseum, the White House and all, everything around it, the media, that's all this, that's the circus. That's, and it's happening, and it's keeping, you know, people like, you know, engaged, or that's keeping their attention occupied or preoccupied, but that's not the whole of reality.
It's not. I just feel fortunate, and I'm just saying it this way, is I was 10 years old living through a similar tone in the 60s with the Vietnam War and stuff, similar tone. Now, I just heard a statistic that there is less violence with the less violence, even though it's advertised, you know, right in our face, than there was in the 60s. There was a lot more violence in the 60s with that disruption, and that's probably because of including the Vietnam War in the streets. And I was 10 years old watching a black and white TV that has come up in me of hoses and dogs in Birmingham. But it just recently came up of from my 10-year-old self is, that's why I fucking hate the way, you know, racism, you know, I had a plan, you know, I had a seed at 10 years old of not liking racism, but then I've had to grow through, well, what is that, you know, like, you know,
I think we're living through like a ripple or some kind of an octave of the 60s, right?
Yeah.
Now.
That's very well put, another turn
of the spiral, another like level of intensity.
Yeah. Very well put. Yeah.
I find myself listening to the music, and I'm going back and what didn't complete itself then that's trying to complete itself now.
And, well, I think a more coherent way of for the hippies to get it together, because they dropped the ball in the 70s and they went commercial. I mean, I'm just riffing off what I feel happened, because they had a momentum, and then when it hit the 70s and also Ronald Reagan, they went too marginalized, and then they didn't stay mainstream, and a lot of them, you know, it went commercial in a bad sense of the way.
Yeah, I think
that's what analysis
like in a nutshell too.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it, of course, but we'll come back.
There's more to it. But that's actually the way I feel what happened with Wilbur's Integral. I mean, I still visited it, but I had this distaste for the marketing. But that's because I still carried a hippie notion of being against. I'm trying to have a better integrated view of capitalism without it being the devil, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I hear you. Me too. So I'm sort of am too. I don't really resonate so much with the conscious capitalism idea. But I prefer it to unconscious capitalism. And
thank you.
I also think that, you know, we can go beyond capitalism, and we could. Yeah.
Well, I think
we could retain the sort of dynamism and the creativity of capitalism in a way that's more cooperative.
There it is, because there is that seed of capitalism, the creativity, like you said, that is part of capitalism, that seed that's part of it to help grow better ways of how we do things.
Mm-hmm. All right. So this is another conversation.
Yeah, it's another.
My brother is in town. He arrived a few days ago. Good. We got his house. We got close to him today.
Thank you for taking the time.
It was my pleasure. I think the conversation wanted to continue through us.
Yeah. Okay. Take care.
All right.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Later.